Okay, I want to cover a few topics from the Sedra, as many as we can get to. Start right away from the beginning. Bereshis describes somewhat the creation of the world, and there are many that are troubled by the discrepancies or the seeming differences between science and the Torah, of how the world got here and how old the world is and so on and so on and so on. First of all, the Torah is not here to teach us science nor to describe the physical description of creation or the world. Torah is more here to guide our lives, and therefore the Torah describes things in a way that we can learn from it in how to lead our lives, and not so much scientific facts. So really the Torah is not a science book, and therefore there's not too much of a place where science and Torah really connect. However, it's also true that the Torah contains within it all of creation. It's God's mind, and the Rabban Hashem used the Torah as the blueprint for the world, and everything that is in the world is somewhere in the Torah, and everything in the Torah is somewhere in the world. And therefore, it would be very difficult if the Torah and the world are at odds. They don't seem to go together. So there are all different ways of resolving these seeming discrepancies between what appears to be, by observation of science. Science is based on observation. Observation is based on the five senses. That's how scientists arrive at the truth of science, which is a relative truth. It's relative to our senses. Torah, on the other hand, is absolute truth. It's revealed truth. It's a truth given by God. Some resolve these discrepancies, if they exist at all, by trying to kvetch into the Torah the ideas of science, accepting or assuming that what science says is 100% absolute truth. And therefore, if the Torah doesn't mention it or whatever, or the Torah says something different, we have to somehow redefine the Torah to make it fit science. That is usually very apologetic, defensive, and not usually true. I'll give you an example. Science, because it is basically relative truth, not absolute, because it depends, again, on observation, experimentation, which all depends on our five senses. Science, therefore, is constantly changing. Torah hasn't changed since it was given. Way back in the beginning of the 1900s, till that point, science believed in what was called the ether. That's not the stuff that you breathe in to go to sleep during an operation. It was a sphere around the earth that they thought facilitated radio waves and light waves were affected by it. It was a the ether was a sphere of something around the earth. Now the Torah doesn't mention ether, so there were those that said, well, we'll say the Rakia, we'll say this and that, and they fetched it into the Torah. Then in the early 1900s, two Jewish scientists, Lemaisa, in trying to prove some of Einstein's theories regarding how light functions, proved conclusively that this concept of ether didn't exist. Wasn't true. And since then, science holds that ether doesn't exist. So now we have to take it out of the Torah. All we kvetched into the Torah to say that this is what ether is, now ether is not anymore in the favor of the scientific world, so there's no purpose to fetch it into the Torah anymore. So they have to change the Torah. If they had waited 100 years, 50 years, they wouldn't have to fetch anything in or out. It's just that science came to a conclusion at one time, came to a different conclusion a different time. So again, it's to feel the necessity that every single thing that science comes up with that seems to contradict the Torah, you have to apologize and defend the Torah and somehow fetch that scientific discovery into the Torah is not necessarily the way to go. Okay? I'm not saying that it's apikoursis to do that, but it's not necessary. Not necessary. Then there's another way. That is by totally discounting science. Scientists are wrong. They don't know what they're talking about, and if the Torah says something, then that's the way it is. That's also not really the way things are, because the Rabbanu Shalom wants us to rely on our senses, and he wants us to come to conclusions according to what we see and what we observe, and to make little or nothing of scientific experimentation and scientific knowledge is also not proper. So what is the solution? When there many times what appears to be a contradiction between science and the Torah is not like that at all. You have to learn and understand the Torah is talking about one thing, science is talking about something else, perhaps. The Torah is talking about spiritual forces, and science is talking about physical forces, especially when it comes to Chazal. So there's no real contradiction, since you don't understand properly either the Torah or the science. There's another way of understanding it, and that is that science, many of the things that science describes are true according to the assumptions they make. But if you make different assumptions, they're not true at all. Example, the age of the universe. Okay, we believe that the Rabbanu Shalom created the world 5,770 years ago. That was the time of Brias HaOlam, or at least Brias HaAdam, which was the sixth day of creation. Yet scientists say it's not a matter of, you know, plus or minus 2 or 3 years. We're talking about the difference between billions of years and thousands of years. Very, very big difference. So some say, well, the Torah doesn't really mean 6 days. It's every day was 1,000 years or an epic or whatever. And when the Torah speaks about 6 days, it really means 6 billion days or 6 million years or whatever it may be. That's one derech of understanding, which is very difficult because the Torah uses the same terminology, right, as a day as how long Yom Kippur is. And Yom Kippur doesn't last, you know, 1 million years or 1,000 years or whatever. It's one day. Erev and Boker, hard to say that in the beginning of the Torah it means one thing and later on it means another thing, even though the Torah also, the Ramban says, that days mean also spiritual concepts, but they also mean the regular physical day. Every physical thing has a spiritual counterpart, and the spiritual counterpart does not necessarily have the same limitations as the physical counterpart. But in any case, that's not here or there. So that's one way that people... Or they say that scientists don't know what they're talking about, right? No moon rock comes with a date on it. They have ways of ascertaining the date, and they're wrong. Their observations are wrong, which is also not necessarily based on any kind of intelligence. So what is a way of understanding? There are other ways and legitimate ways, but the way that, just to show you the methodology... Scientists assume that the world was not created, but the word evolved from some beginning point. After that, because of cause and effect, the world evolved into what we know it today. And the evolutionary process, not only by animals, but by everything. The evolutionary process started with the basic elements, and those elements then evolved into compounds, into various things, and it took time for things to evolve over millions and millions and millions of years. How do they date moon rocks? Or how do they date things that are living things that had died? So they're basically the same idea. You have carbon-14 dating for things that that are basically within the last 5-10,000 years in the scientific terms. And then you have potassium-argon dating, which runs on the same principle, which I'll explain to you in a second, which is for things that are millions and millions of years old. What's the premise? The premise is like this. Let's say carbon-14. Every living thing has in it carbon. And carbon has various isotopes. One of the isotopes of carbon is carbon-14, which is radioactive. It means it's not stable. And every unstable atom strives to be stable, and therefore it gives off the two extra electrons that it has to make it carbon-14 rather than carbon-12. In order to become stable, it has to give them off, and it takes a certain amount of time. We know how long it takes for carbon-14 to turn into carbon-12. Okay, that's called the half-life of carbon-14. It takes a certain amount of time for half of the atoms to change from carbon-14 to carbon-12. It takes a certain amount of years. And we pretty much know how long it takes. Once something dies, okay, so whatever carbon-14 it had within it begins to decay and change to carbon-12. We know pretty much the ratios of carbon-14 to carbon-12. So if you find something that is from a long time ago, and you analyze it, and you find that the ratio between the carbon-14 and the carbon-12 is more heavily weighted to the carbon-12, then you know that a certain percentage of the carbon-14 turned into carbon-12. We know how long it takes for half the atoms of carbon-14 to change to carbon-12, so you just make a simple calculation, and you know how long this thing must have been around, dead, since it started decay. So if you find that the amount of carbon-14 that changed to carbon-12 should have taken 10,000 years to do that, then this must be 10,000 years old, at least, plus a little bit more when it was alive. So you can date it as 10,000 years. That is assuming a few assumptions. One is that the ratios of carbon-14 and carbon-12 were constant now and 10,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. That hasn't changed since what we believe was the creation of the world. Now, there are many factors that could have changed it, including the flood. There are many stressful occasions in history that could have changed. And scientifically speaking, we know that there is a fluctuation in how the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12. Also, that the rate of decay has been constant. As it took as long before for carbon-14 to decay to carbon-12 as it takes, as we can see today. Our observations today, right, we can assume that based on what we see today, that's the way it was then. Also, not necessarily the case. We know that the more cosmic rays that come through the atmosphere, and because of global warming and a million other things, right, the breakdown of the protective shield of the atmosphere, things change, and the breakdown may go faster, may go slower, whatever. There's one more factor, and that's the main factor. So it could be that the scientists' assumptions are not true. They're assuming something. They don't know for sure. They're extrapolating. From what we see now, probably that's the way it was before, but there's no 100% proof one way or the other. And if any of those assumptions are wrong, then the whole dating is meaningless. There's one more point, and that's the ikkar, and that is a good example for all the other kinds of questions. And that's the following. Scientists assume that all the carbon 14, all the carbon 12 came from carbon 14. It took a time for that to evolve. Okay. You know what it can be compared to? The following. I once heard this from somebody, and it's a very good example. You have a tape recorder, okay? I don't know if any of you know what a tape recorder is anymore, but one of those things with a, I was going to say reel-to-reel, but that already is ancient. What's it called? A cassette. And you have a tape of Chazonim with 10 songs on the tape. Okay? Each song takes 3 minutes. You can walk into a room and you hear song 7 playing. You can assume that tape has been playing for how long? 21 minutes. Because every song is 3 minutes. This is the 7th song, so it's getting close to 21 minutes. Somewhere between 18 minutes and 21 minutes is how long that tape has been playing. That's true. But it doesn't take in consideration the fast forward button. What happens if before you walked into that room, somebody decided he didn't like the first 6 songs? So he pushed that little button fast forward, and in a few seconds, he got to song number 7. Didn't take 21 minutes. So it's true. Had the tape recorder gone at its regular speed, it would be a proof that if the 7th song is playing, that it's been playing for 21 minutes, the tape. But if you take in consideration the fast forward button, then there's no proof at all to how long the tape has been playing just because the 7th song is playing, because maybe somebody pushed the fast forward. If you assume that the world evolved, there wasn't a point of creation, there wasn't a creator, and everything had to evolve from more simple, primitive things and either become more complex or less complex, whichever way the evolutionary process went, then if you see something, let's go to the potassium argon, right? Potassium is, there's a isotope of potassium that is unstable, and in order to become stable, it eventually decays into the inert gas called argon. And in every rock, there's a certain percentage of potassium and argon. And if you know how much potassium there was to begin with, and you know how much of that potassium changed into argon, and it takes certain tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years for the half of the atoms of potassium to change to argon, and you know that, what's it called, that if half of the atoms change, it must be at least that old. That is true if you don't assume that there was a God who created the world. But if God created the world, he didn't create it in order to have to evolve to get argon from potassium. The same God that created the process created argon to begin with. I'll give you a more simple example as you could see. Let's take a scientist back to the first day, the 6th day of creation. Adam HaRishon was just created by God. Who changed Adam HaRishon's diapers? No? Nobody. Why? Because he was created mature. He was not created a baby. He was created as a 20-year-old, same thing with Chava. Take a scientist back to the 6th day of creation. Adam HaRishon was just created 5 minutes earlier. Tell that scientist to examine this human being and to tell you how old you think he thinks he is. What will he say? Well, he has mature teeth. He's lost his baby teeth already, right? So it takes at least 16, 17 years, right, 15 years to get all your right adult teeth, right, including the molars and the wisdom teeth or whatever. So it must be 16, 17 years old for sure, right? He's already shaving. He's reached puberty, so he must be at least 16, 17. And the makeup of his body and the size of the bones, I would say that he's about 20 years old. That means the world is at least 20 years old. Not true. The scientist's observations are 100%. But he doesn't take in consideration that there's a creator who created that mature human being. The same creator who created rocks that have argon in them that did not have to evolve from potassium, but God created a mature world. He created redwood trees, not that had to grow from saplings over hundreds of years, but that were created mature, just like he created mature animals. He created light waves that didn't take light years to get to where they were going, but when he created them, they already were created in a way that they were on their path. They were created on the way, because that's a mature world. Right? Not everything had to start from scratch and then evolve, but a mature world was created. Therefore, what the scientists observe is 100% true, assuming that everything only exists because it had to evolve to the point that it is now. But if you accept the fact that there's a creator, then the observation is meaningless. Because it's true. Exactly what they're observing is true, but based on the assumption there's no creation. So you're proving no creation from assuming that there's no creation. But if you accept the fact that there is a creator, then the observation is meaningless. Because if you put the fast-forward button in there, we're not saying God did this to fool us. He created a mature world, that's all. So that's one example of science isn't wrong, and the Torah is not wrong. It's just that we're looking from different points of perspective, and according to your point of perspective, either one could be right. Another example. Evolution says moles, since they live underground and don't come in contact with light, so their eyes atrophied over generations, and therefore moles can't see. Because since they, for years and years and years and years, lived underground, their eyesight became non-existent. Could be. But there's a possibility too, that there's a God who created moles, who knew that they would be underground and not able to see because there's no light, and therefore he created them without eyesight. Created them with eyes, that for whatever reason they have eyes, but they can't see. What's observable is emes. Why it's like that, there's no reason to assume one way or the other way. It depends what your perspective is. Depends what your assumption is. There's one more point I want to bring out, and then we'll go on to something else. And that's the following. There are many times that our five senses, okay, either can be fooled, even though the Torah wants us to rely on them, but they're not absolute. Right? I remember when I was a kid, they had a magazine called Humpty Dumpty Magazine. Magazine for children. And I remember in there they had things that you could do to show you how unstable our senses are. They said, take three bowls of water, one hot, one cold, and one medium. Put your hand in the hot water and then put it into the medium water, it feels cold. Put your hand into the cold water and then into the medium water, feels hot. So you can have two hands in the medium water. One had bitten the hot water, one bit in the cold water, and one feels hot and one feels cold in the medium water. There are a million other things like that of how your senses can be fooled, but even more than that. Not a question of fooling your senses. There's a shaila, right, and a philosophical question, not so much anymore a scientific question. If God knows everything, and he knows it before it happens, because otherwise he doesn't know everything, God knows, there's nothing that God doesn't know before it happens. Okay. So how do we have free choice? We believe that God knows everything, yet we believe that we have free choice. Now, if God knew what I was going to be doing at this moment before I was born, okay, the creation of the world, God knew either I was going to be sitting here teaching you or robbing the Mizrahi Bank in Geula. Okay? Now, if God knew that I was going to be sitting here, then I don't have the choice to go rob the bank, because then God didn't know. And if God thought I was going to be robbing the bank, but I'm sitting here, then God didn't know. Either way. If God knows, then where's my free choice? And you can't say, well, God knew what I was going to choose. When did I choose it? He knew it before. When did I have a chance to make the choice? So, and then God only knows what I'm going to choose. He knows everything. So, it seems to be a total enigma. One of them can't be true. Either God doesn't know everything, or we don't have free choice. And they're both true. How could that be? So Tuzer Rosh Yeshiva gives the following mashal. And it answers a lot of things, if you understand this mashal, especially things that depend on observation and our five senses and the truths of Torah. And that's the following. Imagine a person who has the following problems. He has no sense of touch, can't touch anything. He has no sense of depth. He sees everything in two dimensions, can't see three dimensions. And he has a mental block towards mirrors. You can't explain to him what a mirror is, just beyond his comprehension. You put two candles on a table in front of a mirror, and you write a mitzvah to believe that there are two candles on this table. Now he looks at the table, what does he see? Four candles. So you tell him, well, no, these are three-dimensional. These are only a reflection. They're two-dimensional. He sees them both as two-dimensional. So there's no difference between them. Tell him, well, touch them. You'll see. These you can touch, these you can't. He has no sense of touch. Tell him, well, there's a mirror. It's a reflection. He has a mental block towards mirrors. According to his limitations, there is no way for him to resolve the contradiction between what he sees and what it says on that paper. It says on the paper there are two candles, he sees four. Total contradiction. Give him an operation, let him get a sense of touch, depth, take away his mental block to mirrors, no problem. There's two candles, there's a mirror. Nothing could be simpler. We're in the same boat. Our understanding is very limited. We understand knowledge, knowing something, as pertaining to time. I know something before it happens, I know it while it's happening, I know it after it happens. Three distinct times. And therefore, if I know something before it's going to happen, then either it has to happen or I didn't know. One of the two. And you can't say, even though there are Rishonim who say it, right, but it, according to the Rambam, it doesn't answer the question. Well, God knows what's going to be. He doesn't control it. He leaves the control to us. Just like an astronomer can know when an eclipse is going to be, but he doesn't control it. But again, that doesn't answer the question, because God is not an astronomer. He's not an observer. God's knowledge is absolute, and therefore it can't happen differently. So then there can't be free choice. But that's assuming that God knows as we know. God knows something before. Either it has to happen or he didn't know. But God doesn't know things before or after or during, because God doesn't know things. God's knowledge isn't something separate than him. And God doesn't exist in time. There is no before, after, and during. There's no time, which is something beyond our comprehension. Therefore, we're asking a question from our limited understanding of knowledge and freedom of choice to God. Yes, according to our understanding, if we would know something before, the way we know things, then either it would have to happen or we didn't know it. But God's knowledge is totally different than our knowledge. And there is no time. There's no before, after, during, which is something beyond our comprehension. So for us, according to our understanding, there's no answer to that question. How in the world can it be that you know something before it happens and it either that doesn't have to happen? Can't be. But we're asking from our understanding on God. And God exists in a different plane completely than we do. And his knowledge is different. And there's no time by God. So the question doesn't begin. If we would understand the concept of no time and how God knows, we'd see there's no problem at all. You could know and still doesn't have to happen. How could that be? In our mind, there's no answer. But we're asking from our limited understanding of knowledge and time to God, who has a different knowledge and no time. And therefore, it could be there's no question at all. It's just that we don't have the factor of the mirror, that we don't know about mirrors. But if we'd know about a mirror, then there'd be no problem at all, no contradiction at all. We're missing the understanding of the mirror. That's all. Yeah.
How do we know for sure that Hashem like doesn't go according to time? Like, it just seems like a very neat answer, because like it's just saying that we'll never understand it. So like,
let me give you an example. Is that right? No. Something happened to that clock. What?
It's on our.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. Let me give you an example of how you can understand that there are things that we can't understand. Okay, just that's a fact. Okay, why it applies to this, that's to a certain degree a definition. God means that he's not limited. He's limited, he's not a God. Time limits something. If you exist now, then you don't exist later. So if you're limited by time, you can't be a God. That's a definition. But the, just the fact that there are things beyond our comprehension, I'll give you two examples. That our minds are limited. Close your eyes, not too tightly, because I don't want to be the only person awake here. And picture in your mind nothing. Nothing. Okay? Take your hand and put it into your mind's picture of nothing. Is your hand now in the middle of that nothing? Then that's not nothing. That's space. Try again. Nothing means no space. Try it. You get a headache. You can't even picture it. Why can't you picture it? Because we have no connection to no space. It's outside of our realm completely. But we have a, within our framework, there's always space. Our minds cannot fathom something that we have no connection to, that's beyond our realm. The, give you another example. Imagine something you never saw and never heard of. Impossible. Because you never saw and never heard of it, you have absolutely no connection to it. You can't imagine. What can you imagine? A monster with 10 heads, 4 arms, 6 legs. But all of those things are just combinations of things you saw or heard of. But to imagine something you never saw and never heard of is impossible. So if that's the case, then how do we have a connection to God? Because we only have a connection to God as God within creation. God outside creation is beyond our comprehension. We don't have a name for it. The greatest name, which we don't even say, is Yudke Vovke, which means God as the creator, the Mahaveh, the one who brought things into creation, into existence. God outside of creation, we can't fathom. That's why it says that you can't ask questions from before creation, beyond the world, below the world, meaning outside of this framework, not because it's Osir, because it's impossible. It's outside our point of reference. And something outside your point of reference, our minds can't imagine. That's why the Beis of Bereishis is closed on three sides. Can't ask from before creation, above, beyond, only from what is after creation, because that's what we have a point of reference to. Okay. I didn't want to spend so much time on this, but gave you some things to think about. Okay. Next. Tzelem Elokim. What is Tzelem Elokim? We were created. B'tzelem Elokim. Nasa Adam B'tzalmenu Kidmusenu. Tzelem and Demus. So there are various interpretations. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we were created in the physical appearance of God, because the God does not have a physical appearance. Right? Because God himself says that in the Navi. El mi tedamyuni v'ashava. Who can you compare me to? The Rabbanu Shalom has no form. Not like any form that we can imagine, even like a malach or whatever. So then how are we created in Tzelem and Demus of Hashem? Some say that Tzelem and Demus refer to Bechira. We have free choice, which no other creation, not angels, not animals, nothing else is free-willed. They're all programmed. We are not programmed to a certain degree. We have a certain area, not everything. We have certain area we have free choice, which is similar to God in the fact that he is a free choice being, to do what he wants. He's not programmed. So in that respect, we're like the Rabbanu Shalom. Some say Tzalmenu and Kidmusenu means like the angels, that man is created different than the other creations that were physical creations or spiritual creations. But man is a physical creation that has a spiritual side to him. That's unique in all of the creations, and that is B'tzalmenu Kidmusenu, the more spiritual beings, not God, but Pamal Yishamala, the angels, whatever. Others say that Tzalmenu Kidmusenu refers to Seichel, that people have intelligence. And intelligence goes along with the fact that we can make conscious moral choices. Similar to the first idea that we have free choice. But the free choice comes from seichel, which we have, which other Briyas don't have that kind of seichel. They may have instinct or whatever, but not seichel, the kind of seichel that a human being has. It's interesting that, let me tell you an idea of what I think Tselem and Demus is based on these ideas, not completely different, but to answer a question. It says that Atem Kruyim Adam. Adam, when the Torah speaks about Adam, it and the Nach, it refers to Jews. Only Jews are called Adam. Tosfos says that's Adam, but when it says Ha Adam, it applies even to Goyim. Ha Adam applies even to Goyim. Adam is only Jews. Now, on the surface, it should be just the opposite. Ha Adam with Hey Ayedia should be Jews. Adam Stav is everybody, even Goyim. Why is it just the opposite? So, Tu B'Shvat, maybe I'll tell you a different pshat. But for now, if you look at the Pasuk, it says like this, Nase Adam B'Tzalmenu Kidmusenu. Let us make Adam B'Tzalmenu in our image, Kidmusenu, another word for image, I guess, right? In our likeness. And then it says, Vayas Elokim es ha'adam. Okay? B'tselem vayivra Elokim. What does it say? Does somebody have a chumash bereshis? Handy? No? Okay. Thank you. Says, "Vayivro Elokim es ha'adam b'tzalmo, b'tzelem Elohim bara oso, zochor nekeva bara osam." Few differences. First of all, it says "Naase Adam," and it says "B'tzalmenu kidmusenu." Two things, and it calls him "Naase Adam." Stam. Then, when it says he actually created him, it doesn't say "Vayas Elokim es ha'adam." It says "Vayivro." Elohim es ha'adam, now it has a hey. And it doesn't mention the demus. It says, b'tzalmo, b'tzalem Elohim, baroso. It doesn't say b'demuso. So I want to say what it means is the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu na'aseh, the word asiya always means the perfection, the full tikkun. Ma'asim are things that are finished. God says, the perfection of man, ha'adam, Adam, okay, is B'Tzalmenu Kidmusenu. B'Tzalmenu means he has free choice. He's not like an angel, he's not like an animal. He has free choice. And with that free choice, he can perfect himself to be Domel Hashem. Where do you become like God? How do you become like God? Tselem Elokim, we said, means you have free choice. Now you can use that free choice to become like God. The Torah tells us, right, how to become like God. Mahu afatah. That's midos tovos. Mahu rachum, afatah tehi rachum. And in fact, the word demus is the same letters as midos. Exactly the same letters. So what it says is, nasa adam. God said, the goal is to take adam, okay, and to mankind, and they should be able, with their free choice, the tzelem elokim, to become like God by making the right choices and becoming God-like in their midos. That's demus Elokim. But God didn't make us perfect. He made us imperfect that we have to now perfect ourselves. So when it says vayivra Elokim, that means he created us in our raw state. He didn't, not vayas Elokim, didn't make us complete. He made us incomplete. Vayivra Elokim. What was that incomplete state? Vayivra Elokim es ha'adam. Right? The specific person was made incomplete, and he was made B'Tselem Elokim with free choice. What he's going to do with that free choice, up to him. If he's going to make himself a Demus Elokim or not Demus Elokim. So the Adam is what the Ribbono Shel Olam projected for mankind. What the goal was. The Ha'adam was this specific human being, what's it called, who was created imperfect with a Bechira, right? Not an animal, it's not an angel, right? He has free choice, but he's not Domel Hashem yet. He has to do that himself. Jews have a greater potential, so says the Sfarno, than Stam people, even though Goyim also have that potential, but it's more general by the Jewish people as a people that they're called Adam. That Adam that the Rabban Shalom saw that would use their free choice to be Kodesh, to be Domel Hashem, that applies to the Jewish people as a people. It can apply to individuals, even Goyim. But as a people, Atem Kruyim Adam. You as a people are called Adam. Ha Adam applies to all human beings as an individual human being who is imperfect, who has free choice, it's not an animal, it's not a malach. He can then use his free choice to be domel Hashem. But at this point, that potential is not not so intense. That's the difference. That's what it seems from these pesukim. Okay, let's go to something else. Only have about 20 things here, and I'm trying to think of the ones that we won't cover in some other topic in some other parsha. The Torah says that in the beginning of the world, it didn't rain. But there was a Eid Yalim in Haaretz. There was a natural humidity, a steam or that came out of the earth that watered the whole, that kept everything going. Why? Why didn't it rain yet? Because no man existed, and therefore the Rebbe didn't make it rain. Rashi explains, what does that have to do with men existing, people existing? He said, because there was no human being to recognize the importance and the goodness of rain and daven for it. So the Rebbe didn't make it rain. What do you see from this Rashi? That our perception of why we daven for rain is totally backwards. We think, since the world needs rain for drinking water, for vegetation, for fruit, for food, without rain people would starve and also would die of thirst. So we daven for rain because we need rain. It's not the truth. God could have created a world where there was no need for rain. We wouldn't have the need for what's it called, drinking. Right, we'd be born with all the liquids that we'd need, like a battery. There's a car batteries that you don't have to ever add water. They're worry-free batteries. They're sealed, right, airtight. You never have to add water to your battery. Worry-free. I was trying to. That means you can worry for free. They don't charge you for the worrying, but beyond that, they're not worry-free. But in any case, but supposedly that's what it means. So God could have created trees that don't need rain. Not beyond his capability, or trees that had their own water supply, like in the beginning of creation. But the Rabban Shalom wanted human beings to recognize the need for rain and daven for it. So in order that we should daven, that's why it rains. Not because it rains, we daven. But in order that we should daven, that's why it rains. Let me give you a little bit of an understanding of what that means. The Medrash says that there are three words that are shkulim zekazeh, which means that they're dependent one on the other. Things that are dependent on each other are equal to each other because you can't have one without the other. And they are Adam, Aretz, and Mater. Land, people, rain. Okay? They are dependent. You can't have people without rain and without land. You can't have land without rain, without people. There's no purpose for the land. And so on. So they're dependent. It's interesting, each of those words has a counter word. Adam is also called Ish. What's it called? Aretz is called Adama. And Mater is called Geshem. Two different words. What is the idea? You take Adam, Adama, and Eretz. Adama is the raw state of the ground, the earth. Adama. Aretz represents ratzon, will. You take and cultivate the Adama and you, with your will, and you can, what's it called, bring out things from it that are more perfect than just the plain raw state of things. That's why, I think, on vegetables you make a bari pri ha'adama, and on bread you make a motzi lechem min ha'aretz, not min ha'adama. Because vegetables, you don't have to do anything to them. You eat them as they are from the ground. Most you have to do maybe is cook them. But bread, you have to grind and sift, and you have to perfect. You have to develop it. So it doesn't come the way bread from the Adama. It comes from the Aretz, from the ground that is perfected, that is built up, or whatever. It's a process beyond the raw state. So therefore we refer to it as Aretz, not Adama. Matar and Geshem, also difference. Matar comes from the word Matara, which means the purpose, the goal of the water is to make the earth give liquid to the earth. That's matar. Geshem is more where it comes from, either because the hisgashmus, materializes in the clouds and then rains, or because geshem is go there. It's the not the goal, not where it reaches its goal, but where it's directed from the heavens down. That's why when we speak about Mashiv HaRuach Morid HaGoshem, we speak about the strength of rain, Gvuros Geshamim, it's on the way down, that's when it's strong. When we ask for Matar, we ask for the result. I don't really care how it gets there, just give me the result. I need it for the crops or whatever. So saying Talu Matar al Pnei HaAdama, that's when it reaches the ground. When we speak about the Gvuras Geshamim, that's how it looks when it comes down, strong or whatever. Geshem, so that's Geshem and Matar. Ish and Adam. Adam is in his raw state. Adam in Ha'adama. Ish is a Baal, is someone who, what's it called, who is a master, control. That's why an Isha was never called Adama. The Chorus says, Vayikra Adam, what's a shame Ishto, what's it called? There was Schava. Where does it say, Lazos Yikore Isha, ki me Ish Lukacha Zos. Lechora, his name was Adam. She should have been called Adama. Ki me Adam lukacha zos. But she already was taken from him when he was on a higher level. So a woman never had that lower level. She already was the higher level because she was taken from the Adam who was already an Ish. So me Ish lukacha zos. So a woman never was on that lower level. She was on a much higher level to begin with. Okay, that's just stamina aside. Someday we'll discuss the role of women. Maybe we'll come back to that. In any case, so here again, you have the Adama is the raw state, the Aretz is the more perfected state. Okay, you have the Geshem, which is the where the Geshem is being formed, and the Matar when it hits its target, and you have Adam and Ish. The Adam is in his raw state. Ish is when he's perfected himself. And they're dependent on each other, meaning the following. That people have to perfect themselves and they have to perfect the world. They have to change Adama into Aretz and Adam into Ish. That is our goal in this world. God created an imperfect world. It says that Turnus Rufus HaRasha once asked Rabbi Akiva, what's better, what people make or what God makes? So he expected Rabbi Akiva to say, what God makes is better than what people make. And Rabbi Akiva surprised him, and he said, no, what people make is better than what God makes. Turnus Rufus says, how could that be? He said, very simple. You're going home to eat lunch. Your wife made bread, cake, and cookies. God made wheat, which is better. Obviously, the bread, cake, and cookies. So you see, what man makes is better than what God made. Meaning, God created a raw state world on purpose, imperfect. He wants us to develop it and perfect it along with ourselves. That's the purpose of man. Asher bara Elohim, God created the world in its raw state, la'asos, that man should do. However, there's a danger in that. That people can then think, kochi votsim yod, I'm the creator. I create. I change Oretz, Adam into Oretz, I change me into Ish. So the Rabbanu Shalom put a safety valve called rain, and he controls the rain. And you can do whatever you want to try to change Adama into Oretz. If you don't have rain, it won't work. And rain is something that the Rabbanu Shalom controls. Even till today, science can't make it rain. The most they can do is seed clouds that exist already, and even that's not for sure. There are droughts all over the world, nothing they can do about it. That's one of the maftechos, one of the keys that God held for himself. It's a reminder that people can't control the world. They can't control everything. Even rain they can't control. So the Rabbanu Shalom held that back, but he said that if you conduct yourself properly, then I'm going to give you credit for bringing the rain. Tzadikim, with their tefillas or whatever, can bring the Geshem. Mashiv Aruach, and we say, Rabbanu Shalom, that's why Geshem can be Gishmechem, your rain. Matar is never Mitrechem, it's Mitar Arzachem. Comes in the schus of the ground. But Geshem, if you're Zoche, you could be the source of the rain. But you have to be Zoche to that. So when we ask for rain, we say, God, even you are the source of our rain too. Even the Geshem is you. And when we ask for rain, we don't mention the greatness of rain, then we ask at least for Matar. Even if it's not our rain, at least give it to us. Even if it's only Matar. So therefore, that's what the Rabbanu Shalom did. He gave us the ability to change ourselves from Adam to Ish, to change the Adama to Aretz, but he put in the Geshem as a safety valve that we should remember that we're not the boss, that the Rabbanu Shalom is the one who still is needed to do all of this. He gave us the ability, but we have to do it according to the guidelines he gave us and not think that we're the Balabatim over here. That's the idea of... And therefore, the whole purpose of rain is that we should recognize that we need the Rabbanu Shalom, and that's tefillah. So it wouldn't have been necessary to rain had it not been necessary to daven. But since it's necessary to daven, the Rabbanu Shalom made a world which was necessary to have rain. The same word, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says, later on, it says that Rachel or Rivka was an Akara, and they daven because Rivka was an Akara. No, because Rivka was an Akara, they daven. Not that they daven because Rivka was an Akara. They're putting the horse before the cart. Because Rivka was an Akara, they daven. No. Says the Orach Chaim, that's not the case. Misava Kodesh Baruch Hu Tfilosan Shel Tzadikim. The Rabbanu Shalom wanted them to daven. So he made Rivka an Akara, that their davening should be more intense. So it wasn't that they davened because Rivka was an Akara, but Rivka was an Akara because they had to daven. It's not that because we need rain, we daven, but because we need to daven, that's why we need rain. That's the way to look at the world. Okay. We'll try to find other ways of sneaking in the other things. So.